The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, so first up, we have a story. I guess it's one step towards growing personalized organs.
Right. Sarah, that's sort of the goal of future transplant medicine. One of the really big problems with transplants right now is, first of all, having to wait for an organ from somebody else, A, and then B, hoping your body actually doesn't reject that organ. Wouldn't it be great if doctors could just take some cells from your body, grow you a new liver, and it's yours, so obviously your body is not going to reject it? Well, we're still probably a while away from that. What this new study does is it solves one of the fundamental problems in making that happen. We can grow pretty simple tissues in the lab right now. Things like bladders, which are basically just sort of a thin membrane, skin, which again is just sort of a thin layer of cells. That's pretty feasible right now in the lab. The problem is when you start dealing with thick tissues like organs that are innervated with all of these blood vessels, that's a much more complicated thing to do.
So what are some of the problems with adding blood vessels to layers of cells?
The problem is how do you sort of create the channels within that tissue to put your blood vessels in? Although it might seem simple, well, why don't we just sort of build like, you know, some rubber vessels or whatever and then let the tissue grow around it? The problem is you don't want that rubber in there when you transplant the organ. So how do you get the rubber out? Well, you have to dissolve it to make room for the blood vessels and to get the rubber out of there. And to do that, you've got to use some pretty toxic elements, which are going to be bad for the tissue. So what this team did in this new study was they found a new way to sort of create these channels for blood vessels. And the way they did it was they actually sort of relied on a compound that's actually used in the candy and the cake industry.
Wow. So what kind of candy?
It's apparently used as a decoration for cakes and lollipops. And it's this sort of carbohydrate glass, and it's made out of non-toxic materials. And what's really great about it is it can be molded into a variety of shapes, and you don't have to use toxic substances to dissolve it. So once you've grown your tissue around it, the tissue itself can actually dissolve this material, and then you're just sort of left with the channels where the blood vessels could be.
Okay, so how much does this sugar scaffolding, how much closer does it get us to organs in a jar?
Well, it gets us closer in the sense that now we've got a good non-toxic way to create the channels for these blood vessels. And the research actually showed in the lab that they were able to keep some pretty thick tissue alive. But, you know, organs are a lot more complicated than that. It's not just a bunch of random vessels surrounded by tissue. There's very complex networks of blood vessels that have to go to specific places in the tissue, and they have to reach some places better than others. And so this is just a first step. You're not going to be seeing organs being grown in the lab tomorrow, but it does really get over one of the big roadblocks of making artificial organs a reality.
Really neat. So next up, we have a story on chronic back pain. It's all in our minds, but not in the way that we usually mean.
Right. One of the problems with back pain is that there tends to be two types of back pain sufferers. One that you sort of have a temporary back pain, maybe it lasts for a few weeks or maybe a month or two, and then it goes away. And then there's another group of people that have chronic back pain that can last for a year or longer. And what's interesting is that both of these groups of people can have very similar types of injuries, and yet some of them seem to have much shorter-term pain than others. And doctors obviously want to get to the bottom of this because, especially with people with chronic back pain, they want to figure out, A, is there a way to predict who's going to get chronic pain and who's not? And if they can do that, is there a better way to treat these people so that they don't have this pain that lingers on for months or even for years?
It's my understanding that it's really hard to study pain in people. How did they do it in this case?
Well, what they did was they looked at brain scans of people, and they looked at two particular areas of the brain. They looked at a region called the insula and a region called the nucleus accumbens. And both of these regions are involved in emotional responses to a person's environment and how the brain learns. So it has to really do with how the brain sort of communicates with itself. And the interesting thing they found was they looked at 39 people who had experienced moderate back pain. They would rate the pain maybe about a 5 or a 6 on a scale of 10 for 1 to 4 months. And then over the next year, the team continued to follow these people, scanning their brains. And by year's end, 20 of the patients had recovered. So they weren't having back pain anymore. And 19 continued to hurt. So this was a great population for the researchers because some of these people were obviously suffering from chronic pain and some of them were suffering from temporary pain. And these differences played out in the brain analysis that the researchers were looking at. It turned out that people that had chronic back pain were showing more communication between these two areas of the brain, the insula and the nucleus accumbens, than patients whose pain had subsided. And what was even more interesting is they saw this pattern even way back at the beginning of the study. So it suggests that there's this type of activity in our brain that can somehow be predictive of whether we're going to be a chronic back pain sufferer or just a temporary back pain sufferer.
And do they know whether or not that signaling is always going on, or does it happen after the injury happens?
That's a really good question because, you know, one of the mysteries is, do people's brains predispose them to a certain type of pain, or does the pain cause these changes in the brain? And they really haven't been able to answer that with this study. But more so than any other study, they've really been able to nail down that there does seem to be some sort of predictive neurological marker. You just hurt your back and your doctor might be able to say, well, based on your brain scan, you know, you're just going to be dealing with this pain for a few weeks, so just take some Advil or whatever and you'll be okay. Or your doctor may say, well, look, the brain activity I'm seeing shows that you could be dealing with this pain for a long, long time. Maybe we want to get you into some intensive physical therapy. And again, the researchers are saying maybe this will lead to the development of better drugs. And especially if the pain is somehow related to this crosstalk that's happening in the brain, maybe future drugs could target this crosstalk, limit the amount of communication that these brain regions are having with each other, and maybe that could potentially reduce the amount of chronic pain these people are suffering.
Wow, that sounds pretty exciting. Okay, last up, we have a story about tomatoes and how sometimes when you buy them from the grocery store, they really taste more like the cardboard that they're inside of.
Sometimes they really do. Sometimes they taste like cardboard. Sometimes people complain they taste like water. They just don't really taste like much of anything.
Right.
And this new study is all about why that is. And it turns out the reason might have something to do with tomato aesthetics.
So how they appear.
How they appear. The tomato originated in South America, but now obviously it's grown all over the world. And one of the keys to the way farmers pick tomatoes is they actually pluck the fruit from the vine before they're ripe. And the reason they do this, obviously, is because it's not going to go into the supermarket right away. So they want to have time between when they pluck it and when it appears on the supermarket shelves. Well, it used to be a long time ago, maybe about 70 or so years ago, it was hard to figure out when exactly to pick the tomato at the right time. Because wild tomatoes tend to have these dark green shoulders, and that makes it really hard to determine the right time to harvest. Ideally, you want to harvest when the tomatoes are sort of a uniform green color. Pick it at that time. That sort of ensures that they're a uniform red color when they're in the supermarket. That's been hard to do with wild tomatoes. So what breeders did over the decades was they basically bred tomatoes so that they would have this sort of nice uniform green color at a certain time. Farmers would go, oh, that's really easy. I can tell right away that one, that tomato needs to be picked, pluck it off the vine, ship it off to the supermarket.
So they built in an egg timer, basically.
They sort of did.
Tomatoes are done.
Right. But it turns out, according to this new study, that building in that egg timer actually may have had some not so positive consequences. When the researchers compared wild tomatoes to these tomatoes that have been bred pretty intensively for the past few decades, they identified changes in a gene that's called SLGLK2. And this gene is a transcription factor. And that what that means is basically it's a type of gene that controls where and when other genes are switched on and switched off. And what's interesting about this gene is it seems to be responsible for increasing the formation of chloroplasts in cells. And in plants, chloroplasts are really important for photosynthesis. They take the energy of light to convert carbon dioxide into water and sugar. So the more chloroplast you have, theoretically, the more sugar you have in the fruit.
And chloroplasts are green, and they're responsible for the green color in different parts of the plant.
Exactly. So now you've got this link between the color that the farmers are using to pick the tomato and potentially the amount of chloroplasts in the fruit. What the researchers are saying is that it's possible that by selecting for this uniform, lighter green color, breeders were also selecting for a mutated form of this gene, which caused less chloroplasts to be made. the fewer chloroplasts, the less sugar you've got in your tomato.
There's the food connection.
There's the food connection, exactly. The less sugar you've got, theoretically, the less tasty these tomatoes are.
And you say theoretically because no one can taste them.
Apparently, according to our story, the researchers, for whatever reason, apparently it's for regulatory reasons, were not actually able to taste some of the tomatoes they modified. What they did was they actually modified some tomatoes to boost the levels of this SLGLK2 gene to increase the number of chloroplasts. And they saw an increase in chloroplasts, saw an increase in sugar, but they weren't allowed to taste the tomatoes. So we don't really know if these tomatoes taste any better than they do in the wild, but you would think they probably do because they've got more sugar in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the only difference between a wild tomato and an agriculturally grown tomato, so we're not sure, right, that
right.
this is a big difference.
And in fact, actually, about 80% of the sugar in a tomato is actually produced by the leaves. So even if you're mucking around with the fruit itself, you may not be drastically changing sugar content that much to the effect that you might get a better tasting fruit. So this may not be the holy grail of why tomatoes taste like cardboard, but it's sort of an intriguing possibility.
All right. Well, what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a cosmic mystery about the rapid disappearance of a warm, dusty circumstellar disk. That's all I'm going to tell you about that. Also, a study about how poker might shed light on social decision making. For Science Insider, our science policy blog, we've got a story about new patenting regulations in Europe. Also, a story about new ways to spot scientific fraud. And speaking of scientific fraud, this week's Science Live is all about ethics in research, why there's been a rise in retractions, a rise in scientific misconduct. We'll have some experts on to talk about that. And next week's Science Live is about the Higgs boson, which there's been a lot of talk about this week. We'll have some experts to chat about all the implications of the discoveries that were just announced. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
All right, David. David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.